Blog Talk Radio.
Have you ever wondered why it's happening again?
Welcome to Mindshifters Radio with your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife Jeannie. Michael and Jeannie share with you the wisdom of the ancient Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. They offer tools and support 5 days a week. They will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love. In Aramaic, Rachma. Michael is the author of Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. And now your co-host, the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice.
To the brightness within you and the truth that is rooted within me.
Hi, and welcome to Mindshifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm your co-host, Jeannie Rice, and we welcome you to the show. Today is Monday, June the 9th, 2014. Our calling number is 646-200-4169. Press 1, and that puts you in queue to talk to us. And we would love to hear your comments and your questions because that makes this your show. And while we're waiting for Michael to be with us here in just one moment, I believe this is Suzanne, 314 area code. You're on the air. Is this Suzanne?
Well, hello. Yes. How is everyone?
Hey.
How are you, Jeannie?
I am awesome. Thank you. Welcome to Parent Teacher Talk.
Well, thank you.
How have you been?
We have been well. We have transitioned in full-on summertime here in the Tucker household with all 4 kids off school, and it's been a nice change of pace.
Awesome.
I was speaking with Michael earlier about topics for today, and we were sharing about the power of ritual, and it's a timely topic because everybody's rituals are changing right now. Everybody feels that, I think, if you're a parent or a family, depending on the age of your kids, things change. Things start to shift in May, and you enter into some new routines come June. So I think it'll be a timely topic.
Sounds like an awesome topic.
Hi, Michael.
Hey there, young lady. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Do you open the show in a certain way? Do you need to cover any basic information before we start with the ritual?
You're it, young lady. You're it,
wow.
Young lady. You set the topic today, so we're ready to listen.
Well, that's fabulous. All right. Well, this is a favorite topic for, I think, myself and a lot of the parents in the regular classes that we teach here in St. Louis on positive parenting. And the topic is ritual, the power of ritual. I usually like to cue it up with the understanding of what is ritual. A ritual can be elaborate or can be very simple. It can be the way you brush your teeth, the way you transition from your home into the car, the way you as a family sit down to the dinner table. All of these things are rituals. And I believe, you know, a lot of people think, oh, I don't have a lot of ritual. We don't do a lot of ritual. But really, when pressed, can generally think of one they've done in the last hour. You know, it's one of those things. Oh, I'm not doing it. And then you look at your life and you say, you know what? We are. We always do chocolate chips and our pancakes on Sunday or whatever. Carob chips. Michael, how about for you with your life and ritual? Well, let me say one other thing. The power of ritual for our kids and likely for ourselves, there is a predictability. And predictable equals safe, especially in the child's mind. When a little one knows what's coming, there's that predictability, and they can move into the cognitive development, the cerebral cortex part of the brain, which is their safe learning and growing part of the brain, engaged, learning, testing, and growing. When the child is not in a predictable environment, in a challenged, maybe challenged from their normal routine, what can happen easily for them is they can move into the brainstem, which is where we get the fight, flight, or freeze reflex. And that's what's happening a lot of times with kids where everything changes. You know, you're on a vacation, the bedtime is different, the routine is completely different, and a lot of parents will complain about what is happening to their behaviors. And, you know, it's just really important, I think, to look at the perspective of the child always, what is going on for them. And is it routine or is there a big change-up going on?
Right. Yeah, I agree fully that that routine becomes something that is urgent for the developing brain. And I know that it's something that, although Julie doesn't use the word ritual, she does, you know, set up in her classroom the whole idea of rules so that the children know what's expected of them and how things are going to unfold, and that that opens a space. I don't know whether Julie's with us today or not. Jeannie?
She is with us, and she's on.
Hey, good morning.
Hey,
how are you?
Young lady,
okay.
Welcome. I am well. Good morning.
Yeah, it's afternoon already. I agree. I like the word ritual. I hadn't put it in that perspective, but I really like it. And I definitely had a routine. And I hadn't really put this all together, the importance of the predictability and that it's safe. But definitely had rules, and those rules were always supported, and there was definitely a routine. I like the way you put that together, Suzanne. It was really nice.
Well, thank you, Julie. And I appreciate teachers so much because they come by it so easily. I don't know if it's a personality type thing or it's something that's taught in early education. But when I teach parents, think about the kindergarten classroom if they have kids old enough. You know, and they reflect back to that first day, and we think about how the child has the hook at the right height, and they have the cubby where the lunch goes, and they have the step that helps them wash their hands, and they have the hand-washing song, and they always do that before they sit for snack, and they, you know, and they go to story time, and they always sit on the orange square, and parents, just the heads start nodding up and down, and they can really get, wow, that's really how it is for my child, you know, in kindergarten, and they can think, wow, that's true. They really are so independent, you know, in the classroom. And I think then it's easier to make that leap of how can I apply this to our family life? And where I like to take it is wherever there's a struggle, can you add ritual? And therefore, it's a tool. You know, ritual is not just something we're already doing. It's something we can be doing as a tool to deal with what, quote-unquote, misbehaviors we're perceiving. And it's a really neat, I think, way that parents can be proactive and feel like they're not chasing their tail. Like, we always have a meltdown when it's time to take our shoes off and go in the house, or we are always having a meltdown when I need to buckle them in their seat. You know, these sorts of transitions can be tough. Kudos to the teachers.
Yes, for sure. And there's a place where I've observed from, you know, with raising my children, where I've observed that that can go against the child as well. In particular, I'm thinking about Michael J. was about six. And when Michael J. was born, basically, I didn't go anywhere without him. I had, you know, a backpack, and if I went to a business meeting, if I was going to do a workshop, you know, whatever I was doing, he was there and participating. And I've always had the philosophy that children are not, or parents, pardon me, are not for leaning on, but for making leaning unnecessary. And if a child knows how to do something for themselves, then the parent should not do it, because the child is developing skills in doing it for themselves instead of dependence. It creates that center of control being inside and independence. And so Michael was homeschooled, And about the grade one age, we put him in a Steiner school, which a lot of people just raved about Steiner and how great the education was. I have a lot of friends who had kids who just loved Steiner and went through it. But it got to the point after a very short period of time in the Steiner school where literally Michael Jay would scream, would put his hands and his feet up on the door frame, and we'd have to force him through the door. So the first time that happened, the next day I went into the classroom and spent the day in the classroom with him and just observed. And what became apparent to me was that Michael Jay had, at that stage, an independent mind. And, you know, he knew when the routine was, we're going to have a snack. And he'd get up and he'd go and wash his hands for the snack. And what I observed was that the teacher, not having instructed wash hands for snack, would kind of come down on Michael Jay, make him go to the back of the line and not, you know, like you're going to be last. You knew the snack was coming, you went and washed your hands, but you're going to get back in line and you're going to wash your hands now when we've told you to. And so I think there's got to be a balance in that regard, because that was the only thing I could spot in that school that really got him to the point where, I mean, he refused to participate and we took him out of it. I mean, it was just a very short period of time. And actually that really impacted. Prior to that, his willingness to learn, his love of learning was awesome. And it took a long time to get back to where learning was a joy for him. In fact, I don't know if we ever really got it back fully after that experience. I don't know if there was anything else going on in the classroom, but that was the only thing that I could see that, that you know, worked in the opposite direction. So I certainly know that, that having an expectation, knowing what's coming is important, and I think it can become, it can move in the opposite direction, too, if you're really supporting a child and being independent and really learning to think for themselves and observe and see what's going on and what's coming. Any thoughts from either of you on that?
Oh, I just think it's such a beautiful distinction, because when we talk about rituals, a natural flow of that would be rigidity and triggers on the parent's part or on the caregiver's part. The ritual of life is a flow and an ease, if you think of it as an energy, the ritual being a support, not a prison. And
right.
When you're speaking about the independence and his natural flow or rhythm to go wash his hands, it's a beautiful flow from being told we're going to have a snack. And so held in that light, it's a natural flow, and it can be a very independent ritual. Okay, independence and ritual can coincide. And in a rigidity or in a judgment, when held in judgment, you're not a good listener, you're not a rule follower, that's a reflection on the eye of the beholder, whomever was the leader in this space who was laying that on this child. This child felt that, I would assume, and did not like that disharmony. I think that happens a lot. Kids are little antennas so often when they're, quote, acting out. If we really get underneath it, there can be growth for us, the parent, or the leader, the caregiver, the person holding the space. And it's like for that person who was triggered or challenged by this young man who was taking it upon himself to wash his hands, there's the worksheet. What did that bring up in you that was less than love for this person, for this leader, when this child innocently and quite miraculously got up to wash his hands? It's a very wonderful thing. And I think that's the real opportunity for us as parents and caregivers, is really watching for the triggers within ritual and with outside of ritual. And healing those before we attempt to blame or lay it on the child. You are not a good listener. You are not following. Julie, your perspective?
Right. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that to me, I work towards, I would have honored Michael JSA. Look, Michael J is setting an example, and we all need to wash our hands off, and thanks to Michael J for modeling that. So, you know, I would have been able to be at that place, but sometimes teachers have such rigid structures that they feel like if they're not totally on top of everything, you know, like in charge, then it's out of their control, so to speak. It's a different mindset. I had to change my mindset by doing a lot of worksheets to be able to get to a point where I can feel safe enough to empower children and, you know, to make mistakes in my classroom. You know, I was like in a learning curve just like they were. And when a teacher's not in that learning curve and she doesn't have tools, she's going to hold to the structure. And that's what was happening, it sounds like, to me. And so then Michael J. wasn't following exactly her rigid structure, so then she had to let the kids know that she was still in control. You know, giving up control or the concept of control is it takes some time to do.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
It does.
Right.
And Michael,
go ahead.
Oh, please, you go. That would be. I'd love to hear what your thought is.
Well, I was just going to follow up with Julie on that, and I think that the caregiver really needs to be able to observe when the child is ready to take another level of choice and direction in their process, and to honor that. I think that's so important. And of course, Julie, you got to see in spades Michael J. I don't think you really knew him very much before that happened, but you got to see the impact on him and how much I know you taught him. You know, when you come to Heartland, but you did get to see his resistance to anything to do with learning after that experience. I mean, prior to that experience. And that's good. It was only a couple of weeks. That's all it took. And, mm-hmm. I mean, you got to see that in spades, what his resistance to learning looked like. And, you know, as I say, I don't know that we ever really totally overcame that.
I appreciate your sharing that with us, Michael, because you're right. I mean, when I would work with Michael J., he was always he always seemed to be wanting to go in the opposite direction of the direction that we wanted to work in. And you would ask me to, you know, support him in some worksheets. And, you know, he was always in resistance to that. And I know that when we went on the road, he was in resistance to some other things that you were working towards, getting him to cooperate with you and work together. So I can see what you're talking about as that small thing, that's just that little, what we would consider something really small, can have such a major impact on a person's life. It's amazing.
It is.
He was totally in willingness with learning. He loved learning.
Mm-hmm.
But prior to that one little window, And it's still, actually, I can see places where it still has an impact on him yet today.
Mm-hmm. Your story brings up a couple things for me around that is the belief systems. And, you know, what he was able to form in his little mind. And I think it's a powerful thing for parents to take on that children, our children, first of all, the understanding that we're operating out of a set of belief systems, and that our children are forming theirs. It's a huge motivator. And I know Michael, my husband and I were at Heartland prior to even marriage and prior to children working the tools. You were always foreshadowing, you know, ahead for us. We were seeing our life forward into family life and with children. But it's an interesting thing as a parent to realize that our kids are forming their belief systems And I think it creates a gentleness and an empathy in our parenting, especially when we're really hitting it, when we're bumping up against the edges and we're bumping up against the walls and the resistance, to have that gentle appreciation that belief systems are being formed. And I don't know how that resonates with either of you, but it's been a neat awareness for me, and I think it's given me patience in times that might have otherwise been harder to source. And also forgiveness for myself when you experience a reality in your child. There's a belief system that the life is, or people are, or the world is, that this is very much a way of the world. This is human nature, I would say, in some ways, to take on belief systems.
Right, yeah, for sure. Well, we haven't heard from Dr. Tim yet. Jeannie, is Tim with us today?
He is, and he's on.
Well, let's say hello to the young man and see if he has any thoughts, anything to share on this this topic with us. How are you, sir? Seems like
I'm doing quite well, thank you. I'm doing quite well, thank you. I have to echo the thoughts about the comforting nature of predictability, and I love the way Suzanne was talking about how children who have that structure and comfort can feel more relaxed and then engage the higher functioning of their brain. And those who are constantly out of that pattern don't get to get in that comfort zone, and they don't get to engage the higher, more creative aspects of the brain. They're always living in that stress level response, or, you know, a step or two away from the fight or flight response. So that's a wonderful way to talk about it, and we certainly see a lot of it. Most of the successful ways of helping people who have behavior problems in families begin with the loving, nurturing support and structure from the parents of a consistent schedule and a consistent way of responding to the child. So that's really helpful. And of course, as your example, Michael, points out, it's like everything else, it needs to be in balance. And if there's too much rigidity or negative emotion attached, even the most well-outlined structure can become a trigger for upset. So I would just like to echo what everyone said so far. I don't really have anything big to add to that. Susan laid it out so beautifully.
Michael, may I take this one other direction? When you were speaking about wearing your child and bringing your child with you, I love that. And I want people to, you know, realize when we talk about routine and ritual and structure, the safety that it is, that sometimes even amidst change, which can be moving about the world or moving cities, traveling, sometimes what is the constant is the attachment with the father, mother, caregiver. That attachment, I teach baby massage for the attachment and the closeness and the connectedness and the safety that that both the parent and the child create in that ritual, within the confines of that ritual, within the present mindfulness created through loving touch together. Sometimes those are the glue that binds. Those are the rituals, the songs we're singing as we go to bed, not necessarily only the bed in which we lay the child. So I love that perspective, because some of my parents carry a lot of guilt around change. And when we invite them into the tool that is ritual, then they can have a deeper understanding that they can create the safety and they can create the closeness and the attachment even amidst change and challenge. And you, by wearing your child and carrying your child and being with your child, we're creating a sense of security and connectedness, even amidst the variety of experiences that the child would be exposed to.
Right. Yes, and I think that the way that the parent responds to change has a great deal to do with the way the child is going to respond to change, not only because of genetics, but because of that environmental experience. And I think when the parent models that change is safe and there's always something better coming, you know, that things are just moving uphill and getting better, I think as the parent offers that model to the child, then the child is able to recognize that change is safe and it's good. It's something that they can deal with and keep expanding their world into wider and wider circles. I know that when my children were small, we actually started a school in South Florida. It was a parent-run school. And one of the agreements that all of the parents had, if they had a child in the school, was that, and it was basically a homeschool type group, was that one day per week, each of the parents spent a day in the school once a week. So one day a week, mom was in the classroom with the child. One day a week, dad was in the classroom. And I think that education would move forward in monumental ways if that were part of the routine of educating a child. Any thoughts from the teacher in the expert group today, Julie? How is that fit to do with it?
I had a lot of parents volunteer, and it was always helpful to have parents in the room because they offered a different type of energy and a different type of support. I'm not 100% sure on this, but I thought I remember in China where parents do tend to go to school a lot, and then if their child is sick or something, then the parent has to attend class. There was something about that. That's supporting their education system through parenting. But I do think a parental involvement is actually helpful. At first, it seems a little bit of a shock if you have more than one parent in the classroom because sometimes the children get, they're not used to it. It breaks the routine until they get used to the routine of having other people in the room. Because usually by that time, it takes a while for them to, get a handle on my voice and that my voice now is a voice they need to listen to versus the voice of their parents. So when we bring in other voices and other types of direction, it's a little bit chaotic for a little while, maybe a week or so, and then it sort of blends in. But I think it's a good idea. I do.
I think it's a powerful place. I mean, that's called real life. There are going to be those kinds of chaotic situations that may not always be predictable and controllable, but that is to me is the opportunity for the parent, for the teacher, to model adaptation and being able to really look at a whole situation and take it in stride and move forward in every circumstance. I think it creates a real fluidity in the child to watch the parent do that, the teacher do that, and you know, I love how Suzanne, you expressed it, that these scientists are always studying. In some of the writing that I've done around kids, I've referred to them as learning sponges. They take it all in. And oftentimes the simple fact that the parent is adaptable, the teacher is adaptable and can flow, the child goes, oh, this is the way life works, as opposed to, screech, put the brakes on, change, we got to stop now, there's something wrong here. You know, it's just like, it's such a gift to give the children. And, of course, as you say, Suzanne, it's certainly a space for worksheets for the parent or the teacher who is challenged by change that, you know, feels they have to control it. That, you know, perhaps their childhood was so unpredictable and or maybe even dangerous that they've always got to guard up and there's always got to be control. It's a whole different process to really support the child and being able to flow with, okay, what happens today? What's next?
And that brings up an interesting perspective of the nature of your child, and which is something that's a wonderful thing to reflect on. We talked, I think, in one call about the definition of parenting, or one aspect of parenting. It is my nature as the parent, my child's nature, and the tools I'm using. And, you know, so when speaking about ritual or change, some children are going to gravitate to ritual in the midst of, you know, transitions and changing times easily. And then other children might fight, resist transitions and even ritual amidst change, depending on their little personality and the gifts and challenges they're uniquely here on this planet with. And I think that is a neat perspective, especially for parents of multiple children. You know, I'll hear, well, this never happened with my other child. Why, you know, is this a problem? This was never a problem before. So you're maybe consistent in the same parent, and you're using similar tools, but all of a sudden it's a different child. So I think just having the understanding that this is unique per each child, depending on their nature. And their sensory integration ability. I think we need to factor that in, the way that a child, the tools and the abilities they have to be with sensory information. It's a big factor for kids and transitions.
Talk a little more about that. When you're talking about the sensory information, mm-hmm. you're talking about just how much information they're able to process, how many different things going on.
Yes, as a physical therapist, I worked in the schools as a team with an OT and a speech therapist. And some of the goals always for therapists in the school setting is to support their learning versus their activities of daily living or the things you might focus on in an outpatient setting. In a school setting, it is how can the therapy we're doing support the child in their learning. And one of the things that would come up frequently in children with developmental delays or sensory integration issues, people might think of them as autism or some other sensory diagnoses, it is where a child has difficulty managing what you and I might think of as normal input into the body through the normal senses, their sight, their hearing, their sense of touch, smell, taste, proprioception and vestibular, that what we think of as our balance systems. So children can go either way. They get overwhelmed very easily, or some children actually need a lot of sensory information to actually feel balanced, to feel, quote, alive. So those are the kids that we think are bouncing off the walls or, quote, hyper. They're in search of heightened sensory experiences, bumping into people, instead of patting gently, hitting hard, pushing, you know, moving ballistically. And these are things we can support once we know what we're dealing with. We can have tools for that. And what happens, I see it in my classes, sometimes these are missed and they're taken to be behavioral issues. And it gets very challenging for the parents. Parenting a child with these undiagnosed needs, if they take them on personally, quote unquote, Dr. Tim, I love your line. I've used it often. It's not personal. You could take everything seriously, but you don't have to take it personally. I think it can often come to a place where parents are just taking it personally. What have I done wrong? What's wrong with you that you would push another child or hit or bite or why are you bouncing off the wall, you know? And so, you know, within ritual, there are rituals that can be supportive to kids that have higher sensory needs. And we could talk about those specifically, but I'd love to hear Julie and Dr. Chan, both your perspectives in your practices. Have
well,
you worked
I get,
with children? That,
oh, yeah. I get a lot of that. And
mm-hmm.
and you hit it very well. I mean, it's there are some fabulous books that have been written in the past 15 years or so about people who had, and literally, to my mind, genius people who've had different levels of experience on the autism spectrum, mm-hmm. who have grown up and written books about their experience. So it's given the, quote, professionals, unquote, a whole new level of access to what's actually going on inside the mind and body of someone who's doing headbanging or doing other obsessive rituals and won't wear clothes or won't wear certain kinds of clothes. And Temple Grandin the guy who did On a Blue Day. Anyway, things like if you imagine that somebody has access to the volume control of your hearing, and in 1 minute someone is saying something and it's a perfectly comfortable level, and all of a sudden on a scale of 0 to 10, they bump it up to a 40. And it sounds like the same person who was talking to you in a comfortable, regular tone is now screaming just inches from your ear. This is the kind of dysregulation, they call it, that can happen within the nervous system of certain people. And if you have a child who doesn't seem to be responding to the basic limit setting, the loving touch, the rituals and consistency that you would put into place, this is a good place to look. They may be having a very, very different internal experience than other children their age and other children in their family. And before we leave it, I just want to go back to what Michael was saying about change. As Michael was talking, I was thinking about how often I would get comments because I would take my children everywhere, especially when they were very young and they would be sleeping. And I would tutor people in statistics and put them in the car and drive them with me, and we could talk and sing on the way. And then we'd get there and they'd be sleeping and I'd do my work with the person, or they'd be smiling and playing with toys and I'd be coaching or teaching statistics or research design. And so it isn't just a matter of you have to keep them in one house, in one bed, in one little, you know, very prescribed ritual. However, as the consistency of the parent's relationship with the child, I can't emphasize that too strongly. I had the gift of being raised by two very loving and supportive parents, both of whom tended to think very well on their feet in a crisis. And I saw this come out in me at different times with my children. I didn't even have to think about it. And I remember one time in particular that came to mind while Michael was talking about how the parent responds is of critical importance to how the child learns to respond to certain things. My son was probably a year and a half, maybe 2 years old, and we were out at a summer party, and somebody was playing with him, and there was a kiddie pool. And this person thought it would be fun, after a while of playing with him in the pool, to pick my son up by his ankles and start swinging him and pretend he was going to dunk him head down in the pool. And for maybe 2 or 3 seconds, I saw this flash of horror on my son's face. And without even thinking, I just went right over to him in a swoop and just scooped him up. I didn't even look at or address or touch the adult. I just scooped my son up in my arms, right out of the other person's hands, and just said, "Oh, we know that this is fine, and no one would hurt you here." And now he's upright and in my loving arms, and he was smiling in an instant. And my response was, "This is all about loving and protecting him." And that incident went, and I'm sure he has, if he has any memory of it at all, it was just a fun memory. But that flash of horror on his face, if I had bought into that or been attacking of the other adult, all of that negative energy that would have been going around would have been available for him to access with that memory. So it's just one case in point that the more I can work to be loving and consistent in the presence of my children, especially when they're young, the more I'm providing them with a different loving substance for them, as Michael was just saying, to be a sponge to soak up.
Absolutely.
I'm in full agreement with you there, Kim, and I think those early experiences are so important to how a child can expand their horizons. I know in my family system as a child, you know, my grandmother was just like one of my favorite people in the world. And right from the very earliest age, every time I had an opportunity to go to my grandmother's and spend a day or two or three or a week or the summer, I was there. None of my siblings would even go and spend the night at my grandmother's. And, you know, I look at that today and look at the relationship of, you know, I've pretty much gone around the globe, and I'm the only one in the family that's moved more than 20 miles from our original home. Everybody else is still within 20 miles of our original home. And I think that the safety of being able to step out and reach out was something that I'm not sure where or how I learned that. I suspect it was in relationship to my mom, because we were really close, and she was a pretty courageous lady. And somehow or other, that didn't seem, and it, you know, it might just be a personality difference, but it didn't seem to transfer to my three siblings. And so we certainly live very different lives, and I think that when the parent is mindful of every response they have is impacting everything the child learns, it's such a powerful place to be.
I love that. I did a talk last week with an occupational therapist and a nutritionist, and we were talking about tools for transitions. And so we had about 20 minutes to speak, and the two things that we spoke about, number one, were the power tools of parenting, and I would say even ritual, are the sort of the big tools, the earth movers. We liken it to planting a garden. These are the earth movers that are taking out and clearing the field and then bringing in the fertile soil. And for me, the power tools for parenting are two things, is the love, just holding love present, and the empathy that flows from that love. And those, for me, those are the power tools, is holding love present and empathy. In that context, the child knows themselves as both connected and powerful. And I feel in the challenges that I come up against, if I can stay with the love and the reflection back to my child that they are powerful, that we can together move through things that are even challenging for me in the moment or challenging for them in the moment, with that as sort of the context. And I would say even for ritual, if you can, as opposed to the rigidity or the structure of it, is the flow of it, and that love be present and that their child have a sense of power. So back to the original story of Michael, was love present and did the child have a sense of themselves as powerful when, you know, he was being reprimanded for, quote, moving outside of the class ritual? And I would say probably no. And if the teacher might have sourced both the sense of connection and love, I think even redirecting him would have potentially been possible. If Julie, yeah, you know, you talk about the need for structure and order for teachers, I think it's very similar with lots of parents, lots of different personality types, wanting the sense of control or structure. And that's where I get into, there's a lot of tools out there in our parenting. What the most important, the power tool is love, present and active, and as the child in a safe place and a sense of power. We can get into then the hand tools, of what do I say, what do I do, and it's exactly how do I potty train, how do I discipline, when we have those power tools in place.
And I think another factor, too, to look at, especially for the child that, as Dr. Tim was talking about, you know, all of a sudden the volume has gone from a gentle, caring voice to screaming and raging in one's ear when nothing has happened externally. I think that is something that our culture does not make parents aware of in a significant fashion, or a factor, a significant way, is the importance of what they're putting in the child's mouth, the artificial mm-hmm. colors, the chemicals, and mm-hmm. some of the things that are just were never designed to go into the human body that food purveyors or so-called food purveyors, you know, if it comes in a box, it really isn't food. And I think that that is something that so often a parent needs to start to look at if they're feeding them at McDonald's. Yeah, they're probably going to have behavior problems. I mean, if you go into the arena of animal training, let's say dog trainers, the first thing they'll tell the owner of a dog that's bringing them for training is, you got to feed them properly. If you feed them junk, if you feed them things that are not going to support their harmonious function, then you're going to have a problem training this dog. It's going to be a problem dog. And the neurotoxicity that comes from so many of these artificial chemicals, so much of the garbage that's in vaccinations, it's just unbelievable what this culture has come to as a norm. And for parents to be able to step up and speak up and say no is so, so important. And it's often a factor that's totally overlooked because and to many people, the medical doctor is the god, and in many cases, the medical doctor had, you know, two classes of an hour or two each in nutrition, and you know, the pharmaceutical industry is hand in hand with the food production industry. They're all part of the same cabal, and some of the garbage that they're putting into these children's bodies is literally, I believe, criminal. Any mm-hmm. thoughts in that direction from any of you?
I had a personal experience as a mother with this, with a teen who was having migraines out of nowhere, and just a really disempowering experience of being told that nutrition didn't matter by our MD, which we then left. I had suggested I might keep a food diary, a journal, to track her. She had no migraines, and then they were happening every 2 weeks, sometimes even more frequently, and very debilitating, between 1 to 5 days of not being able to eat and just being in a dark room. It was very confusing as a parent to be a part of, and to go to the medical profession and be told that really that's a pat nice idea, but it's really worthless. So, but if you'd like to do that, go ahead. So we found a new doctor, and with research through the Mayo Clinic, found that 40% of migraine sufferers respond to biocitrate magnesium, this very simple over-the-counter supplement. When we started the biocitrate magnesium back in October, it took 1 month, and knock on everything wood in my area, we've been migraine-free, and we did not try that supplementation for almost a year, because it had been so discouraged and poo-pooed, and it was our own journey to get to that empowered place of, well, what can we do? And we exhausted some of our other opportunities, and it was a real gift. So I would invite every parent on any journey with any diagnosed dysfunction or disorder into nutrition, absolutely, and any adult dealing with any diagnosed, you know, medical concern or health, well-being. You don't have to be broken.
Yeah, exactly. That's absolutely. You know, back it's about 20 years ago now, maybe a little more than that, I had a stepson who had cancer, and he took me into where he was being treated at his father's demand. His father was very medically oriented. And so he ended up in a large, well-respected children's hospital. And the day we took him in for his first treatment, he was in a room with another child who had a similar cancer where they said there was about a 4 in 10 chance that they would make it through and live through that cancer. And when we were taking him into the room, the parents and the doctor were standing in their overjoyed conversation at the fact that this young man who just had cancer surgery had eaten his first meal. He ate a whole hot dog and drank a half a can of Coke. The doctor and the parents were just overjoyed. And it was just like, for me, it was just such a shocker to see a children's hospital where a medical doctor should still be thinking in those terms. Mm-hmm. And it, unfortunately, I think it's probably exacerbated since then. It's just, it's bizarre. It's just bizarre. Mm-hmm. And the thousands of studies that have been published, and yet they're just totally, and I'm talking peer review, of course, you know that, peer-reviewed stuff, but they're just ignoring it like, well, no, it didn't close with me, therefore it's ridiculous. And so often when people have an opportunity to heal something, they go for treatment instead, and it prevents the healing process. And mm-hmm. it's definitely, I think, time to wake up across the board, and especially bringing these children up to believe that pills are the answer to everything is just a really tough place to be.
And bringing the topic full circle back to nutrition with ritual, one interesting thing to look at is what are the rituals around your family mealtime? Because sometimes mealtime becomes battle time for families. They get invested in whatever fear or conditioning or control. These are things that come up. I know I'm a mom of 4, and you want your kids to eat healthy, and children of different ages, they have different desires for independence. And so one of the things that's been really helpful for our family is to look at mealtime. What are our goals? Our goals are for family time first, and for feeding ourselves, you know, body, mind, and spirit, not just the food. And so we let go a lot of the power struggles with our kids around food with just the rituals we have. So the response we have is, I'm not hungry. Well, you don't need to eat, but we're sitting together because that's our ritual. We sit together. And if families adopt that response, it's about sitting together at the table, not forcing you to eat. A lot of the kids that are having the most trouble with power and control, they want to take it to the mealtime. If you can let go of your end of the rope, you know, there's no tug of war that can happen. A lot of times that child at the table just wants permission to not, quote, have to eat, and they're going to eat if they're hungry. And if you provide balanced foods in your home, they can have a lot of freedom of choice of those foods that you provide, you know, that are at the table. So there's a lot of neat rituals and strategies for creating balance and connectedness at the mealtime, at the table, that I know of. And I just know that this is for young families, especially in the area that can become quite easily a battle every night. And I think it's an interesting perspective when we talk, rituals aren't all positive. Your ritual can be, I whine, I cry, I stamp, I go on the floor until I get what I want, and then I get what I want. And that can be a family ritual, and that could happen every night,
yes.
You know. So.
For sure. And I think that the power of parents making the time in their day to sit down at that mealtime and really, with sincere interest, want to know about the child and what the child's day has been about and what it's been like is such an empowering thing for a child to actually have the parents full attention. And in this day and age of electronics and television and, you know, so many families sit down and eat the meal in front of the tube. And, you know, what they're taking in, the receptivity of the brain at feeding time is very powerful. And to make that an exclusive family time where media's off, the computer's off, the phones are off, and the family really is just in that space together with interest in each other's lives is, I think, a huge contribution to make to the child. And, of course, to the parent, because what they're going to receive in that is just monumental.
Julie or Tim, do you have something to share there?
I didn't hear the question.
Well, we were sharing around rituals at the dinner table. And
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it'd be wonderful if parents would, you know, actually bring their children home and stop doing all these extracurricular activities and have family dinners again. We always had family dinners as a child. I mean, that was just it. That was just, we got together at 6 o'clock and we were having dinner. And we talked about our day, just like Michael was saying. But my experience as a teacher and even as a friend of some of my parents who, you know, some of my friends that still have children, there's so many extracurricular activities that those dinners at home are not happening. And a lot of times, even when I went back for this last visit, somebody is sitting there with a computer, somebody is texting, somebody is getting on something else, you know, with another device. And it's like there was no, you know, interaction. There was no ritual that brought us together at all. And, you know, I was really surprised, but I think it is a sign of the times. In fact, somebody was doing some research recently where she she had pictures of movies of children on playgrounds in the 50s, and everybody was playing and, you know, on the swings, on the, you know, the merry-go-round that was there, on the slide, you know, there was somebody playing softball, whatever, basketball. But anyway, when she took pictures now in 2014, everybody is sitting and they have some sort of device in their hand, and there is no playing on the playgrounds. And I think that what she was wanting to do is inspire going back to the 50s and getting people to actually interact and do something different other than having some sort of device in their hand. So if you're doing that as a family, I honor you for that.
Mm-hmm. One of the greatest gifts for us, we are sitting down, and I have always guarded downtime as uptime. This is important creative playtime and minimized, you know, outside of the home activities in the evening. One of the greatest blessings for us has been the ritual of our thank yous. And that's the power of ritual. It can pull you, the parent. If you're having a night where you're off, you have a family ritual. We go around and we say our thank you fors. We were calling it what we're thankful for, but our three-year-old would say, what I thank you for, and so now we call it our thank you fors. And we do it every night. And we do it every night. And we have a friend in over, one of the other children, and it's a lovely thing to share. And I think they get excited. And we're asking, what are you thank you for? So it's an easy, simple thing that parents and families can do.
Thank you for dinner time. That's cool. Awesome. Well, we're down to about a minute or so, so we're going to have to close out the show. We thank you each for your input. It's awesome. I'm so delighted that we're able to provide this support for parents and for teachers and bring forward a new level of understanding from these great minds that you have. What a gift. In the meantime, if you happen to be in Bristol, Tennessee, Jeannie and I will be doing Why Is This Happening to Me Again at the office of the medical doctor, Dr. Schrenker, here in town. You can look on our website. Get a copy of the flyer if you'd like to join us on Friday morning. It'll start at 8 in the morning, go through until noon. We've got an awesome medical doctor here who his conversations, just like ours, forgiveness comes first. And so he's actually bringing his staff in to study the forgiveness process. Come and join us. And then on Saturday morning, I'm going to be heading to St. Louis. We need to talk, Suzanne, and see if we're doing something with parents there. And we've got a couple of workshops. You can check those out in St. Louis the next week. So we appreciate each of you who joins us. We are blessed by this gathering every time we do it. And we invite you to give the world the best gift you can for the best year you have. Return life blessings.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice, and his wife, Jeannie, who present six-step internal Aramaic process of forgiveness. Michael and Jeannie are here every Monday through Friday on Earth Angels Radio. For more on Michael and Jeannie, please visit www.whyagain.com. That's www.whyagain.com.
Evolving continuously.